If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Being influenced by outside ideas and thought, and for me to have worked in the 90s in Saint-Emilion in the right bank, and being able to see so much of the ideas that were so important to wine and would become so important to wine was something that changed my life.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 473. This week we feature Daniel Dow of Patrimony Estate in Paso Robles. Passion, patience, and palate. Words Daniel Dow of Patrimony Estate lives by. Daniel has a deep love for wine and understands the time and care it takes to bring grapes to their highest representation of terroir. I spoke with Daniel on the phone a few weeks ago and intently listened to the story of what it is to make great wine. You can also hear Daniel on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term vine balance. I'm on the phone today with Daniel Dow, and Daniel is the co-proprietor as well as winemaker for Patrimony Estate. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing great, Ray. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being on the podcast. A few things I just want to talk about right away in advance. You are in Paso Robles, correct?
That's correct.
I find it interesting, something that your website commented about, making wine as good as other areas. Many people are making great wine. I think sometimes it's more publicity and advertising that makes some other places stand out. Is that fair to say?
That is totally fair to say. And to me, it comes down to the science. It comes down to the data. Numbers don't lie. Numbers get through the marketing BS, if I may say. It's really about, you know, we have so much history about winemaking. We have so much history about terroir and other things related to wine. And I think you have to take in consideration those as well as the science to really understand why we think that this is a very unique terroir, like none of the other terroirs in the world. And I can obviously drill down into that.
You are in the Adelaida district, which is an AVA that goes back to about 2014. Tell me about that area. What is it like?
So that's a great question. Let's start with a basic concept. You know, when you talk about wine quality, you talk about terroir. Terroir, a French word that comes from the word terre. But it really means many things, as you probably very well know. The two predominant things it means, though, is soil and climate. We're going to take away the winemaking part and other technical details when it comes to describing terroir. But terroir is a way to describe basically the location, the place you're at. And specifically, you want to talk about soil and climate. Probably the two most important elements that are going to describe the quality of your wine. So it's important to look at terroir and determine and discuss what is it that's so different where we are that we believe is a jewel of ecological elements that actually doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet. Once we understand terroir, we can delve into what it means for the wines and relate to that. But we want to spend, if you don't mind, a few minutes talking about terroir.
Sure, absolutely.
Let's start with soil. Okay, we have thousands of history when it comes to winemaking. What do we know about soils? We know that, for instance, going back to the Romans, they planted their vines on a certain soil. They sought these soils all over Europe specifically that basically were called in French argilo-calcaire or in English calcareous clay. These are extremely popular soils in Europe. If you look at Burgundy, if you look at Bordeaux, if you look at the Rhone region, if you look at the Loire Valley, if you look at Champagne, if you look at Alsace, even Tuscany and other places in Europe, you will find that calcareous clay soils are extremely unique when it comes to growing grapes. I was just in Bordeaux, actually, about a month ago, and I happened to be looking for property in Bordeaux and in Saint-Emilion, to be exact. And, you know, the broker who was showing me the property made an interesting comment. He said a hectare is about 100,000 euros here in Saint-Emilion. But that's if it's not calcareous clay. If it is calcareous, it's $1 million in euro.
Wow.
A million. So a million versus 100,000. So what is it that's so unique about these soils that basically define the way vineyards are planted in Europe, which give basically the certain signature that wines from Europe have? Earthiness, mineral, freshness, elegance, balance, all these things come from the soils. So these soils are very unique. You have basically two components that make up one. You've got the clay, and you've got the limestone subsoil, or let's just say the calcareous part. So the clay is going to give you three things, right? It's going to give you color. Now, why is color important? Because color is texture. And a wine that's textural is a superior wine because also it is correlated to higher density. So a wine that's dense, a wine that's textural, is a superior wine. And color is directly correlated to that. So color is very important. Let's go to the second thing. The clay gives you bouquet, that beautiful floral bouquet you basically get when you drink a wine. That comes from the clay. Last, the clay is going to give you fat and flesh in the wine, which also is important in terms of creating that texture that we're looking for. The calcareous part is going to give you three things as well. The calcareous part is going to give you, one, the ability to dry farm. As you probably very well know, most vineyards in California, I would say probably 99% of the vineyards in California, are not dry farmed. They're irrigated,
yeah,
and heavily irrigated,
right,
for that matter. Many California Cabernets, top-notch Cabernet vineyards in California, are irrigated between 3 to 6 gallons a week throughout the entire year, at least the growing season, and some of them throughout the entire year. So these soils allow you to dry farm. There is no need for outside irrigation. Why? Because the limestone acts as a sponge and provides the necessary moisture for the vines to survive. So these soils do that. The second thing these soils do is they allow you to make unadulterated natural wines. The vast majority of calves in California are heavily acidulated at harvest, so you add tartaric acid to stabilize the wine.
Mm-hmm.
These soils allow you to make wines that are not acidulated. They allow you to make naturally made wines that reflect the purest expression of what the terroir gives you, what the vineyard gives you. The last thing that these soils do is they go beyond fruit and alcohol. You know, they give you freshness, they give you elegance, they give you minerality, they give you earthiness. That is why most of Europe searches these soils to plant vineyards on. These soils are very unique. There's only one bad news about these soils, Ray, and maybe you figured it out by now. You don't find them in California.
Right.
California wines tend to be on four soils: clay, loam, sandy, and volcanic. You will be hard-pressed to find old world wines on these soils. You'll find them. You find some gravel. You find some pebble. But at the end of the day, it's like, for instance, Bordeaux. It's mostly clay with a limestone subsoil. Now, places like the Left Bank, you need drainage because it's Cabernet Sauvignon, and Cabernet Sauvignon hates a lot of water. So the pebbles that are intermixed with the clay help drain basically the soil, which gives better quality Cabernet. But
sure,
in places like California where it doesn't rain, they don't do anything. Pebbles are not going to give you anything. You can't penetrate a pebble for drawing out minerality. It's only the limestone subsoil that gives you that minerality, where you taste the wine and you get crushed stones and you get the beautiful minerality and earthiness that comes from these soils because it's porous and the roots are able to penetrate it and draw out these flavors into the wine. So what we have on our vineyard is exactly the same soils as you find in Europe. It is the same composition as the soil in Bordeaux or Burgundy or in Champagne or anywhere else, for that matter. And these soils, like I said, are renowned for making superior wines. Now, let's talk about the climate. Climate is arguably one of the most misunderstood subjects when it comes to Paso. Let me put things in perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Paso is 614,000 acres. It is larger than Napa and Sonoma. It is twice the size of Bordeaux. And Bordeaux is huge, by the way.
Sure.
I mean, you could drive an hour and a half to 2 hours and barely cross Bordeaux. So twice the size of Bordeaux is gigantic. So I can't tell you how many times I read articles from critics many times and journalists that come to Paso. They stay downtown. It's in August where it's very hot, or July downtown. And they leave and say, well, I've been to Paso, and it is very hot in Paso. That would be like me going to Carneros, staying in Carneros, leaving and writing an article that I've been to Napa and Sonoma, and it's very cold there. I wonder how they grow cab.
Right, exactly.
Which will be frankly, not very smart, but yet I hear that on a weekly basis. Let's look at climate. So first of all, we are the only vineyard in the entire state of California that's at 2,200 feet elevation, but only 14 miles from the very cold Pacific Ocean. So what does that add to our temperature? Well, to put it very simply, our temperature, our climate, is somewhere between Bordeaux and Napa. It tends to be 3 to 5 degrees cooler than Napa, 5 to 7 degrees warmer than Bordeaux, and 5 to 7 degrees cooler than Paso downtown, which is quite a bit of a difference. The other way you look at climate is by measuring the number of days that reach 100 degrees per year, because there's a direct correlation with too many 100-degree days and inferior quality. Why? Because when you get to 100 degrees or so, the vine shuts down and no longer produces sugar.
Right.
You basically have a canopy burn. You have a sunburn on the grapes, which depletes phenolics, depletes color, depletes flavors. You know, so there's a direct correlation with lower quality. So you don't want to have too many days at 100 degrees. Well, let's take, for instance, 2019, a cooler year in California. Paso, downtown, where people often stay, can actually saw 28 days at 100 degrees that year. And that was a cool year. Napa, Santa Elena, which is kind of an average between Calistoga and Oakville, if you may say, saw 11 days at 100 degrees. Even Pauillac that year, the birthplace of Cabernet Sauvignon in Bordeaux, saw 4 days at 100 degrees. They loved that year. They called it a California year. It was warmer. They were able to achieve beautiful phenolic maturity. But they saw 4 days. In the entire calendar year of 2019, our mountains saw 0 days reach 100 degrees, not a single day.
Wow.
2020, the same story. It was a very warm year. It was the third warmest year on record. We saw 6 days. Paso downtown saw 32. Napa saw 13. So our average temperature, again, if you look at these two vintages, just to look at the last two, we tend to track 3 to 5 degrees cooler than Napa, 5 to 7 cooler than Paso. So we found a perfect climate to achieve ripeness year after year without overcooking the grapes, without creating very heavy wines that lack elegance and lack freshness, still maintaining beautiful minerality and elegance into the wines while having tremendous power. This terroir that we found doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet. And it's allowing us to make wines that are causing serious disruption in the wine industry. Let me give you an example. 9 years ago, we launched our first Soul of a Line, which is our highest end under DAO, the DAO label. Now, we'll talk about patrimony in a second. That wine, for $150, wanted to compete with Cabernets from all over the world. People literally laughed at us, saying, "You are crazy." I actually was in a meeting with about 11 vintners in Paso, and they told me, you're wasting your time. You could never compete with Napa. You know, we should focus on other varieties. That's exactly what I heard. And we had a lot of naysayers. Would it shock you if I told you, Ray, that the last 2 years in the state of California, in the home state of most wineries that are famous in the United States, Soul of a Lion, on and off-premise combined, has outsold every high-end cab from California besides one winery?
Well done. Wow.
What does that tell you, though? It tells you that the consumer is going to decide where the best wines are and the best prices.
Right.
And that's really what we provide. Even at a higher end price, such as Patrimony, we're still considered a value compared to wines that are not as good that sell for 3, 4, 5 times more.
Well, at the end of the day, people are going to buy the wines that they want, the wines that they enjoy the taste.
Exactly.
And have learned about, you know, more often than not, price isn't quite as big of a deal.
Exactly. What I like to say is, you know, a consumer may buy a bottle of wine because they heard some great ratings about it or because a friend recommended it. But at the end of the day, one of two things are going to happen. If they fall in love with this wine, they're going to buy it over and over and over again. And if it's just an okay wine, yeah, they'll drink it here and there once in a while. But that's about it.
Right.
And what we're seeing is a viral effect on our wines. People are buying them saying, that's incredible quality for the price, so I'm going to buy them again. Which is why in a matter of 8 years, Soul of a Lion became the number two now most sold Cabernet in the on and off premise market in California. And that wave is actually reverberating from all over the world right now. We're in 50 countries.
Wow. Again, part of what we like to do is introduce people to different winemaking areas because sometimes there's just obviously a great lack of education out there. But let's talk about you and build up here. You originally are from Lebanon, correct?
Correct. We were born in Lebanon and grew up in France.
And when you say we, I want to make sure this is you and your brother who started the winery. So this is a family winery, you could say.
Correct.
And
it is.
I detect the French accent in your voice, which is really cool. How did that occur that you ended up moving to France? And then what about your own beginning in wine? How did you learn about wine?
Great. Thanks for asking. We were born in Lebanon. Dad is Lebanese. My mom was born on a French island and grew up between the French island and France. Came to Lebanon when she was in her early 20s. Fell in love with a handsome dude. My dad was actually Mr. Lebanon in 1951.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And 2 weeks later, they were married. And it was basically a beautiful love story. Lebanon is a French-speaking country. It used to be a French colony. And the fact that it is, and the fact that my mom was born in a French island, we spoke French at home, and we had both citizenships. We had the Lebanese and the French citizenship. And when the war started, you know, the Civil War started in 1973, the first terrorist attack that happened in Lebanon, unfortunately, came to our house. So my brother and I were severely wounded. We almost died. Mm. And right when things calmed down for a little while and they started again, my parents said, you know, enough is enough. Let's just get out of here for now and see what happens. So we immigrated to France, where we spent the majority of our youth growing up between Paris and Cannes, which is in the south of France. Growing up in France was fantastic. You know, we love living in France. And it is there that, you know, I developed a passion for wine. My dad used to drink a bottle of wine every day. He would have half of it at lunch, and he would finish it at night. And I remember being 13 years old, and I would spend time with our dad, and he would pour me a little wine, and he would get philosophical, he would talk about life. And I really cherish these times together because they left an indelible, you know, memory in terms of great souvenirs. And that's really where my passion for wine started. We immigrated to the U.S. when we were 18 years old. My brother is 4 years older, so he came earlier than I did. And, you know, we were looking for the American dream. We didn't have a penny for our name. Pretty much had $20 in our pocket. So we got jobs. Both attended the University of California, San Diego, where we majored in computer engineering for myself and electrical engineering for my brother. And then we were broke, and my parents were broke, so they immigrated to the U.S., and we wanted to take care of them. So we started our first company building computer networks for the healthcare industry. I was 21. My brother was 25. And America gave us an opportunity to shine and tap into our potential. So we were able to take our company 10 years later in public and end up retiring at a very young age.
Very nice.
You know, my passion for wine became very, very dominant in my 20s. And in my mid-20s, I quickly realized that my true calling was actually not to be an engineer or an executive, but actually to be a winemaker. Mm. So at first, my family was shocked. They were like, you've worked so hard to get here, and you're an engineer, you're an executive, you're successful, and you're going to bet it all on becoming a farmer. And, you know, to me, it was about pursuing my passion. I was in love with wine. As we say in French, j'étais fou du vin. I was crazy about wine. So I started studying. I was mentored by two great mentors. And having already had my computer engineering degree, I didn't feel I had to go back to school. So I got the two textbooks that are mostly used at UC Davis for the Oenology department. And I went through them in a few months, which was very easy. And then I started making wine. And the rest of this day is history. I mean, this was my 16th harvest this year, 2021. So 16 harvests that I've had as a winemaker. And I am as crazy about it today as I was, you know, 20 years ago.
As it should be.
Yes. It's a beautiful thing. You know, it's a beautiful thing to be in touch with the earth, to be in touch with nature, to be in touch with, I hate to call it a product, with this food that just evolves and leaves an incredible memory. When I drink a bottle of wine, especially one that I made from a certain year, you know, I remember this year. I remember the people that were around, especially my parents that I've lost, you know, 10 years ago, and my sister that I lost also 10 years ago. Reminds me of the people that were around. You know, it's just a beautiful thing. You know, wine is just it's just, to me, the biggest sign of civilization.
Yes.
Something that's been around for thousands of years and that continues to evolve and continues to, you know, be so unique. It's not like any other thing on the market, you know, that you can find.
No, there's nothing else like that. I want to go back to what you said a few moments ago, though. You said you had two mentors. Who were those people?
So the first mentor, actually, I just saw her about 3 weeks ago. I was in Bordeaux, a wonderful lady, very talented. She was the winemaker at Chateau L'Evangile in 2000 in Bordeaux, and she's been the winemaker at Chateau Lascombe now for, I think, 20 years. Her name is Delphine Barbeau. She's been an incredible friend and an incredible mentor. Obviously, not anymore now, but 16 years ago or so.
Sure.
The second mentor was from Napa, a very bright winemaker who has become a dear friend as well and has really helped me, helped shape kind of my initial education on wine. The gentleman's name is Scott McLeod. He was the winemaker at Rubicon for 18 years. So those were very influential people in my life when it came to winemaking.
Very nice. Scott, I want to talk about him for a minute. I interviewed Scott, probably about 10 years ago when he was still at Rubicon, and I've lost touch with him. Do you know where he is these days?
Yes. Scott is providing consulting services to many wineries. He also started an incredible company with his partner, Gianni Colantuoni, revolutionizing the way people measure phenolics for wine. His system now is being used all over the world, in France and other countries. He also is part of a group that has a place called Safe Harbor in Napa that provides fermentations and wine storage and other wine services. So he's doing great. He's extremely talented, and I would say he's been a great influence when it comes to winemaking, and as well as a dear friend.
That's great, and he's a really nice guy.
He's a great guy.
Especially when we started this project.
Yeah, I'll tell you this funny story, because you interviewed him in 10, right, 2010?
I'm going to say probably more like 2008 or 9.
Yeah, 2010, I think he had gone on his own already.
Yeah.
I remember him tasting the first vintage of Soul of a Lion. And he went out with a line that we actually had on our website that said, thou is going to make a cab within 5 years that will rival any cab in the world. And people called him from everywhere saying, are you crazy? Oscar's going to compete with Bordeaux and Napa. He says, well, taste the wines. And he was almost prophetic because 5 years exactly from what he said that is when every critic came out and said, we rival the best of Bordeaux and Napa. So he's been a great influence for me, for sure, when it comes to winemaking.
Yeah, he's a smart guy. And as an aside, I have several of his Rubicon bottles still in my cellar, happily taking a rest. So
yes.
I look forward to cracking those because those were really great wines. Okay, back to the interview. Yeah. One more time, I'm going to go back to one other thing you mentioned. You said the vineyards were at 2,200 feet. Is that right?
Correct. 2,200 feet elevation, the highest elevation in Paso.
Yeah, that got my attention right away. That's up there pretty well.
Yeah, that's why our highs are lower. If you talk to a pilot, they'll tell you that for every 1,000 feet, you drop about 5 degrees or so.
Yeah.
So the fact we're at 2,200 feet, I mean, Adelaida in general is all mountainous. So it's higher elevation than the rest of Paso. The higher elevation you get, the better temperature, the better highs you get. This is why we see 0 to 5 days at 100 degrees per year, while downtown or the east side of Paso, we'll see 30 to 40.
Interesting. You know, we were talking about your mentors. The question I like to ask winemakers is, what's the most unusual advice you've ever been given?
Great question. When I first got mentored by Delphine from France, you know, being an engineer, sometimes I can be very technical. So the first time I met her, I was showing her the first wine that I had made, and we're tasting through it, and I'm going, the pH is this, and the acidity is this, and this is... She goes, stop. I go, what's going on? She goes, if you want to make great wines, you got to stop thinking as a guy. You got to start thinking as a woman. Be in touch with your senses more. And I've taken this advice to heart. I try to think like a woman. You know, women have extremely talented palates, better than most men. And they can be extremely talented, especially with winemakers. You know, we have several very successful women winemakers in Paso, and we definitely need more of them. So it was a compliment in a lot of ways, and it taught me how to not rely too much on my left brain, but more on my right brain.
Sure.
I got that right, I think, yeah.
Sure. Certainly very good advice.
Yes.
So when we started the interview, you were talking about looking at property in Bordeaux. Are you looking to expand that way, kind of go back to your roots? What's your purpose for that right now?
So I'm definitely looking to expand to Europe, but I'm leaning more toward Tuscany, which I have fallen in love with for several years. I've been looking for about 5 years for a great property to actually have a Tuscan venture. I see the same potential in Tuscany that I saw in Paso, similar soils, similar landscape, similar climate. It is the closest place I could find to what we have here. And I love the people, love the food. I did look at Bordeaux, and I'm still looking at Bordeaux, but I'm leaning toward Tuscany. The Bordeaux venture was more for my daughter, who just finished with her master's degree in winemaking and finishing a 6-month internship at Chateau Latour very proud of her.
Wow.
And I was thinking maybe I'll get her an estate to be focused on, but I think I'm leaning more toward Tuscany for sure.
Well, we definitely have to stay in touch with you on that. I'd like to see how that progresses.
Absolutely.
A couple of basic, simple things I want to ask, and that is simply, how many acres are you farming?
So we have a total of 900 acres in the Paso Robles Arboleda Appellation. And we will be farming as of next year, probably around, let me look the numbers quickly, about 300 acres.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, we started out with 26. We've been accumulating more land as time goes by. We've accumulated almost 900 acres. And right now we have about 150 acres under production. And we'll be adding another 150 in the next year, most likely. Some of it may be in 2 years from now.
And you're producing, specifically, how many wines are you making under the Patrimony label?
Right now, the Patrimony label has four SKUs. Has a Cabernet Sauvignon, which is the predominant wine that is made for Patrimony. It has a Cabernet Franc, which is a very small production. It actually has a very small production. We're talking two barrels of a Patrimony cab called the Black Label Series, which is very unique. And then last, there is a Patrimony wine called Cave de Lion, which is a Cave of the Lions, which comes from my property and my brother's, and that's a small production as well. But the main driver for Patrimony is our Patrimony Cabernet Sauvignon.
And about how many cases are you doing total, roughly?
Total of about 1,200 cases right now. We hope to get to 5,000 cases here in the next 5 years.
Well, small is always good in my book, that's for sure.
Yep.
So as brothers, what is your brother's role in the winery?
George is a genius at understanding consumer trends, marketing, sales, relationships. You know, we run the business day-to-day together, but I really focus on the production. I manage the vineyards, make the wines, oversee all the winemaking, and he focuses on the sales and the marketing in the day-to-day.
So is there one great lesson that you've learned, one particular mantra you live by as a winemaker?
I do. And my team, when I first, I pretty much trained most of my team that works under me. And one of the things I told them is that you can average sugars, but you cannot average flavors. It's something that I live and die by, and I explain that. One of the things that I've done, I do a lot of research. I do about, you know, four or five trials a year over now the last probably a dozen years. And one of the things I saw is that many times winemakers focus on only the sugars. They'll go out and they'll sample randomly some grapes from a block. If they get enough sugar to make wine, they'll say, okay, let's just harvest. Many times what you find is that there was a lack of vine balance in the vineyard. So some grapes may have been raisiny and plummy. Others were green and tart inside. And I tell my team, you can average sugars, but you can't average flavors. You'll go to taste this wine, and you'll have raisiny, pruny flavors competing with, you know, very green flavors. And that's when you taste the wine, you go, I don't like it. And then you have to resort to adding sugar, and you have to resort to doing all these things, which we don't do.
Mm.
So what I do is I focus on vine balance in order for me not to average flavor. So we plant five times more vines per acre than most vineyards in California. We go up to 3,630 vines per acre.
Mm.
Most vineyards have about 700 vines per acre in California. And the reason we do that is because I want to make sure that all these clusters are ripening at the same level, so that I'm not averaging flavors. That's how I believe I can make a wine that not only is concentrated, it's got great colors, got enough alcohol, etc., but that also has the right flavors inside the wine. So that is something that I take very seriously when it comes to making the wine.
Sure, that's fair enough. Now, this may seem kind of like a silly question here, but I've been more interested in it lately. When you're approaching harvest, are you the kind of winemaker that uses a refractometer? Are you the one that simply goes out there and tastes? Is it a combination of things when you're ready to determine harvest?
My decision is always based on my palate for everything. But I'm also an engineer, and I like to measure. And the reason why is because it gives me an early warning system. So let me give you an example. I track in the vineyard growing degree days. I track phenolic maturity. I track pH. I track acidity. All these things are not decision makers for me. But so let me explain. If I've got 300 acres that are producing grapes, I am not superhuman. I cannot be walking the vineyard and covering 300 acres every day to basically find out what the quality of the wine is and make a decision.
Sure.
So what I've done is I've created all these parameters, and I have my own, you know, I hate to use the word formula, but my own parameters, ranges, where if I'm getting these results on a daily basis, I know when those numbers give me an early warning system. So they'll say, for instance, this block may be in the range. So then I can go and double-click on that block and spend an hour walking the block, tasting the grapes, and making that decision. So that's what I use the technology for. But the final decision is always based on me tasting the grapes.
Combination of heart and science when you get right down to it, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm sure you've done plenty of media, plenty of interviews in your career. And this is my favorite question to ask winemakers. And that is, for that period of time, what's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
You're making me think, Ray.
I'm a sneaky guy that way.
Question that I've never been asked that I would like to be asked. You know what? I'll tell you a question that I've never been asked. You know, often when you look at our winery, often when people look at our successes, they mischaracterize the story. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, oh yeah, these are two rich guys who decided to start a winery in Paso Robles, and that is such a mischaracterization. What I would like to be asked is, what were the sacrifices you made when you actually started the winery?
And what were those sacrifices?
You know, I came to this country with nothing in my pocket. I had $20. We ate pasta for 2 months, struggled to make ends meet, paid for our college education. And by the time I was 31, I retired, and I could have just played golf the rest of my life and tennis, which are the two things that I like to do, and hike and basically, you know, do nothing. But the truth is, I bet it all on becoming a farmer.
Hmm.
And if I had lost... And as you know, 99% of the wineries are not successful when they launch. There's a cemetery of trophy wineries out there, of wineries that got started and basically they went nowhere. But the truth is, when I decided to pursue my passion, both my brother and I decided to bet all the security we had acquired into a new venture that was close to our heart. If I had not been successful, I'd be looking for a job right now.
Very gutsy move. And obviously it's paid off.
Yes, it has.
Daniel, most importantly, for our listeners who'd like to learn more about you and about Patrimony, what is your website?
It's patrimonyestate.com, P-A-T-R-I-M-O-N-Y, estate, E-S-T-A-T-E.com.
And is there any other way you'd like to have people contact you?
Instagram, they can follow me. I have a lot of information that I post on a regular basis that's very educational. So Instagram is a good place to follow me as well, and as well as Patrimony Estate, both on Facebook and Instagram has a Patrimony Estate side, as well as myself.
Very good. Daniel, I certainly appreciate you taking the time today to chat with me. I wish you continued success. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ray. I really enjoyed it.
Learn more by visiting patrimonyestate.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geisha. Our intern is Clement Maddox. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.